Good afternoon. The Senate Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Hello, everyone. We'll get right to it and look at the work plan we have for the rest of this interim. And Chris, can you walk us through sort of what we have there, which is not an elaborate plan, but point by point?
Sure. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So what we have, and work plan may be a bit too large a word, but we have the 6 points here of work that will be occupying our time for the rest of this year and then into 2020. And the first one is House Bill 3427, fine-tuning and technical issues. This, of course, is the Student Success Act and the creation of the corporate activity tax. As the Department of Revenue begins and goes through the rulemaking process, we expect certain issues to come up, as well as stakeholders will be raising various issues, technical and from the technical to the policy. So that'll be part of the discussion the committee will take up in 2020. So it's really just preparing for that. And I don't know exactly what will be in the bill at this point, but at least for staff's position, we're focusing on technical aspects. And then the second item is the Senate Bill 193 report. This is the interstate broadcasters taxation. Just to remind the committee, this is where there is some disagreement between the industry and the Department of Revenue on how they're taxed, and there are a certain number of court cases going forward. And we have a temporary apportionment policy in place for the broadcasters. It got put into place in 2014. It was extended in 2017. And the question is, I think the committee was getting a little bit tired of just these one-year extensions. And so the idea is, instead of waiting for the tax court to rule everything, because there are a number of cases that are either in the magistrate or working their way through the court system, that LRO was tasked with a report on possible policy options for how they should be taxed. Rather than seeing how the court cases come out, what are some options for the committee to consider on how these businesses should be taxed? We've already started this work. We've had one or two meetings with industry to get their perspective, and we've had another meeting or two with the Department of Revenue. And ultimately, the goal is for the February session, and even by legislative days in November, to have come a long way with at least some policy options for the members of the committee to consider with eventually a bill. If a bill isn't proposed in 2020, we'll be back in a situation where do we go with the old apportionment method, which was this audience factor, or do we extend again for some time period this domicile process? The third item is an annual bill. It's the Federal Reconnect. At the moment, I don't think there's much on the radar screen as being relevant. I don't know that the feds have passed much, but if you're following the news, there are statements about what Congress may or may not do in the last few months. And so we'll know more about that as the rest of the year unfolds. But right now, it would be looking like a pretty vanilla bill. And every year, we do need at least an annual update that changes the date of connection from December 31st of one year to the next. Under current law, we're tied to December 31st, 2018. This bill, at a minimum, would change that date to December 31st, 2019. And the fourth item is a corporate activity report. Given the magnitude and significance of that tax, we'll be putting together a report that contains a lot of the work that the committee did last session, and just a kind of a repository of all of the analysis that went into that work. We don't have a firm deadline for that report yet, and a couple of the others statutorily probably take precedence, but that's on our radar screen. The fifth item is another report required by statute, House Bill 2128, and this pertains to the definition of tax expenditures and these implicit sunsets. For the longest time period, whether or not something was a tax expenditure was arguably an academic discussion. People could disagree, and there was no real consequence to person A believing something was a tax expenditure and person B believing it was not. But in the 2013 legislature, there was an automatic sunset put on all tax expenditures of 6 years, so that if during the creation of a policy that looked like a tax expenditure, if it was silent on whether or not there was a sunset, it would have an automatic six-year sunset. And 2020 was the first year we've hit that. So we're in this world now, and the Department of Revenue raised a number of issues in putting together the last tax expenditure report. And so whether or not a policy is or is not a tax expenditure does have a real impact, because if it is deemed to be a tax expenditure and there's no comment on the sunset date, then it automatically goes away after 6 years. And so we got our first taste of struggling with these policies during the 2019 session. So the gist of this report was to, there wasn't enough time in the session to really flush it out. So it's continuing that work. And the deadline for the report is actually not until the 2021 session. So this isn't a mandatory item for the February session, but if we can make enough progress on it, it'll probably help the Department of Revenue and the legislature during the creation of the next tax expenditure report. And the last item is kind of a catch-all, potential property tax issues. There are always issues, as veteran members know, there are always issues related to the property tax. And the House is going through a number of, or at least they have on their work plan, a number of projects related to the property tax. I don't know how many of them might make their way through the House side over here, so that's kind of a catch-all, just a heads up that some property tax issues may be coming your way.
Okay, and I think tentatively now we've got four committee pre-session file bills for February. It's really those first three issues.
Correct.
Yeah. Assuming Senator Benz goes along with that. And as you mentioned, so far Federal Connect, it's basically empty except moving the date from December 31st,
2018. And I think that's the case. We haven't done our deep dive yet, but nothing comes to mind as to what a pressing issue might be at the federal level.
And the tax expenditure issue is incredibly subjective and technical. I know the House Revenue Committee spent all session on that and could not figure out a good way to delineate between what we would consider a tax expenditure and something that may not be but still sunsets. So that's a thorny one too. And our favorite on this committee is the tale of two houses, and I hope sometime in our lifetime that can be fixed. Questions on the work plan? Senator Riley and Senator Taylor are both jet lagged, and so you're excused from paying close attention. Senator Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I would like to add something. It arises from the last revenue estimate, where there was a question about why so much money was pouring into the state, and there was some vague reference to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act at the federal level, but no real statement of the impact of that on our own system. But apparently there's been some impact, and I'd sure like to know what it was. And so if we could add that to this list, that would be great. And then someone could come in and say, well, this is why so much money poured in, and this is when you could expect it to all stop, or whatever. But there, something happened, and we never got a clear answer. So I'd like to get one.
Yeah.
So.
Senator Taylor? Okay. Well, do you want to go into the tax credit report, Chris? Mm-hmm. Kyle?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, what I have for you today is just sort of a preview of even getting ahead of the 2020 session, but something that'll be coming up in the 2021, the next long session. And that is the tax credit report. And this is something, and the tax credit review process in general. And that's something that the committee is pretty familiar with. This process was just done in the long session in 2019. So I'm referring to the and Chris alluded a little bit to this in the sunsets, the both implicit and specified sunsets of tax expenditures, or in this case, tax credits, but there was a review process put in place for all the tax credits. And the way it was set up was generally just to review these things on a cycle of every long session. And it was set up through the sunset process of these tax credits for every 6 years. So it sets it up so every credit is more or less reviewed every 6 years. And it's done so in that long session. So today is just really an update on the upcoming review, what credits will be included in that. And a little bit, I'll touch briefly on the background and the process again, but try not to spend too much time there as the committee just went through that a few months ago. So that's what I have for you today. And then I'll finish up, in addition of just listing the tax credits that are set for review and the cost to extend, the revenue loss estimates for those tax credits, is I'll also finish with some implications of some recent changes following the Tax Cut and Jobs Act and how that's in some ways filtered through to affect some of our tax credits here in Oregon, specific to primarily these are the contribution match tax credits, where you make a contribution to something and then the state gives you a tax credit of a full amount, or usually it's going to be a percentage of that contribution. And then we also have tax credits, auction tax credits. And these are the two types that were primarily affected through some of the changes at the federal level. So I'll touch on that at the very end here. But just to start, or really what's a quick review of the statutory requirements of this tax credit review process. One of those requirements, in addition to the sunsets on the individual tax credits, is the requirement that LRO prepares a report. And so that's something we do prior to the start of the long session. And that report includes background information. You can see in the table that's up there on the slide. These are the information that's required for each of the tax credits for LRO to include. And the general idea is really take each tax credit one by one and identify the policy purpose of that tax credit, and then try to look into, well, how effective is the tax credit? So it's describing the policy purpose and the credit itself, and then looking at, well, what was kind of the desire or the desirable outcome of that credit? And then how well is it achieving that? And that's just like a broad synopsis of what's in the report. But again, there are specific requirements to that, as well as other things that can be included that may be helpful in the legislature's deliberations on whether or not to extend that sunset or to make any policy changes as well. Included in the report is also a requirement 315.047 is just a truing up of more or less tax credit estimates. So when we put these estimates out that are in the revenue impact statement for the bill to extend the sunset, we then have to include a table in the tax credit report that more or less describes, well, here's what the actual revenue impacts were, and here's what they were, the projections were when they were made for the bill. So it just trues up those estimates with the actuals that actually came in. And then the last one I included here is ORS 315.044, which is just a requirement of a statement of purpose for any proponent that has a bill to create a new tax credit or to modify a tax credit in a substantial way, I suppose. So there is that statement of purpose, and usually the legislature will get this just through the public hearing process of the bill to create the new credit or modify an existing one. So the process itself, the review process, right now what we're doing, or what LRO has begun to do, is we're preparing for the next tax credit report. So we'll be spending the next year or so getting that report ready for the upcoming long session, the 2021 session. So it is now the time that we're gathering some of the information and the data and really looking into some of the historical context of these credits. So if there is any information in past tax credit review reports or something that the committee would like us to look at, now's a good time to, you know, let us know, and we can try to incorporate those suggestions into the next report as well. Okay, so the next two slides I have for you, this first one is, these are the list of the tax credits that are scheduled to, for the most part, all these were scheduled to sunset in 2022. It'd be January 1st, 2022, so that would be the first year in which taxpayers would no longer be able to take this tax credit. And so the review process then takes place, or is set up right now, that the standard review process would have the legislature review these in 2021, giving the legislature the opportunity to, if the sunset is extended, the taxpayer won't notice it. There's no change for the taxpayer, because when they go to file their taxes, the credit will still be there rather than being a lag or anything like that. So it really is, it gets the legislature out in front to make any changes or just to simply extend the sunset. Excuse me, but so this is the list we have for the 2021 long session. And there are some, in some cases, there's a bit of a similarity with the process that the committee just went through in 19, in that if you look at the table, the way to really read this, I should explain the table really quickly. As you have the list in the tax credits, the number here, this corresponds with the number that's in the governor's tax expenditure report. So that way you can kind of cross between the two reports to see the different information. But the biennium, these estimates here is the estimate of the cost to extend. So the standard way that this is set up right now is that these tax credits have sunsets on them. So if nothing has changed, these tax credits would be scheduled to sunset, more or less go away. So the cost of extending them really says, well, this is the revenue impact. This is what would happen to the general fund if you extend these and make no policy changes. Those are the assumptions there. So in 21-23 biennium, it would be about, it's $54.9 million, or about $55 million is that cost to extend all of the tax credits that are in that list in front of you. And again, the way it's set up is these credits sunset midway through the biennium. So when you look at 23-25, the number is usually about double or so. And again, that's the reason for that is just that's the one tax year that's sunset in the middle of the 21-23 biennium. But so in some cases, similar to, as I was saying, the 19 session, you can see that there is one tax credit, the working family household and dependent care, that accounts for about 32 million or 60% or so of the total 55 million cost to extend. And then you have a few other credits that also are in the $6 million range that account for the next big chunk. So just the top four or so credits account for quite a bit of that 55 million. So it's similar in some cases to 19, where the earned income tax credit was accounting for a lot of that revenue impact of the list that the legislature just went through in 19. And then the second page of this is just the remainder tax credits. These are scheduled in 2023, 2025, and 2027. So again, because of that six-year review process, you can see those scheduled for review in 2025 are the ones just reviewed in 2019. So that's 6 years further out, and that's where the cycle process begins again. So what I thought I'd do next is just touch on a few of the larger tax credits that are set scheduled in 2021 and just give a little brief description of what they are and what to be thinking about going forward, but I won't dive into each individual one. But again, as I was saying, the working family household and dependent care credit is the single largest of those, accounting for about 60%. And I should mention too that many of these tax credits, this is the second iteration of review for them. So these were done, these were reviewed in many cases in 2015 was the first report and the first time the legislature went through this process. So these tax credits for the most part have all been reviewed about 6 years ago or so and were extended or modified, or in some cases with the working family household, actually is a credit that was a combination of two that were being reviewed at the time. So in this case, it was the child independent care credit and the working family child care credit were both up for review back in 2015. Those two were allowed to sunset, but they were more or less combined into the working family household and dependent care credit as part of the review process, because there was quite a bit of overlap in terms of policy, what the policy implications were for those two credits. But so this credit, it's a refundable tax credit, which is part of the reason that it can lead to higher costs than some other credits, just because it is refundable. So if you lack the tax liability necessary to take it, you can still get that full amount refunded to you. And the design of the credit is really it's aimed at taxpayers that have low or moderate income and they have dependent care expenses. The best example of this would just be a one or two parent household that has children in daycare and they're both working, or one's working and one's attending school or something on those lines. And the credit is really just a percentage of those childcare expenses. And the design of the credit, the chart that you see in front of you there is just showing how the credit works as a taxpayer's adjusted gross income compared to as a percentage of the federal poverty level. So as that goes up, the amount of the credit will go up until about 100% of AGI, adjusted gross income, to federal poverty level before the credit begins to phase out. So it's sort of a ramp-up process and then slowly phases back out. So the credit then will be decreasing as you earn more income above that 100% of federal poverty level.
Kyle, where does this go beyond the tax credit? We just expanded a little bit there, an income tax credit. I certainly recall Oregon wasn't in really the top. We were like in the bottom third of states that matched that earned income tax credit, but most states didn't have this. And I just wonder, for simplicity's sake, what would we be losing if we took this $32 million and just added it, you know, dollar for dollar onto the earned income tax credit? Would we, I know we would simplify things, that's for sure, but who would lose under that trade?
The general would be the working family household. This credit in front of you here is more focused, I suppose, on it would be taxpayers that have dependent care expenses is really the main focus. So if you, and it really is set for, in many cases, this is going to be a child under the age of 13, if your youngest child is who will receive the credit. So it more focuses the credit on households that are going to have children with child care expenses, or families, yeah, with children that are in paid child care, I suppose. So it's something we could definitely look at in more in depth and prepare some background information. But where the earned income tax credit, I guess it's not necessarily the exact same group, although there is quite a bit of overlap there. So that is something we could definitely explore a little bit further to see how these two credits maybe affect some of the same taxpayers.
Yeah, because this is fairly complex where a tax credit. There's quite a few hoops to jump through. Not for the Department of Revenue, I mean for them too, but for a taxpayer.
Yeah, absolutely, Mr. Chair. And these are the type of things that the tax credit report, I think, is really there for, as well as in some cases, looking at this stuff, these types of questions ahead of time and preparing that for your review ahead of the legislative session, rather than trying to do it right in the middle of it when the bill's being reviewed. But those are the type of things, just to put like a plug out there, if there's other things in these tax credits that you'd like us to look at, it can definitely give us the lead time to try to prepare that in more detail, for sure.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hassan. I just wanted to clarify something. So when it was enacted in 2015, that wasn't for the first time, was it? Or was that for the first time it was enacted? Or was it increased from a previous session? Or
yeah.
I just wanted to understand the history a little bit. I can't remember, so.
Senator Taylor, there were two credits that covered similar people and taxpayers, although one was refundable, one wasn't, so that they definitely weren't the exact same credit. But yeah, this was the first year. This credit more or less replaced those two.
Okay.
And it was created through a work group process as well in 15 of looking at ways, well, we have these two credits for review. They cross over, they're hitting some of the same taxpayers. Is there a way maybe we could redesign it or something on those lines to be more beneficial to this group or something on those lines? Or why have two credits when you could just have one and make it a little bit more simple for the taxpayer to claim this benefit that you would like them to receive? Okay, so I'll move on from this one. The next grouping is really two credits, but they're serving, they both have disability, I suppose, in their name is part of the overlap there, but it's a personal exemption, additional personal exemption credit. So Oregon has a standard personal exemption credit, which is essentially just a credit for each taxpayer and then each dependent on the return. And it's the most recently is worth about $200. It's indexed to inflation, so it creeps up a little bit. But so for these taxpayers, if the first one is just severe disability, so that'd be for the taxpayer themselves. If they're severely disabled, or a spouse, if you're married, filing jointly, is severely disabled, you receive an additional personal exemption credit. So you essentially receive an additional credit of $200 on your return. And then the second credit here is the child with a disability, which is similar. You get that additional personal exemption credit for a child with a disability. Now, the definition of disability is not the same for the child with a disability for the severe as compared to the severe disability, but the credit itself is the same thing where you get that additional personal exemption credit. They both do have an income limit of $100,000 in AGI, so that applies to both of them. So there is some similarity there, which is why I put them on the same slide here. And then the last one that I have for just an overview here, and this one is the individual development account or IDA contributions. This committee, or the Joint Tax Credits Committee, touched on this a little bit in the last session, so it might sound somewhat familiar, but this is a contributions credit. So it's a credit that's available to taxpayers that make a contribution to a fiduciary organization that then distributes those contributions, that money. It's more or less a funding mechanism. So you make a contribution, that money is then distributed through the IDA program, which is a program that it's really about matching savings accounts with low or moderate income individuals that are saving for perhaps purchasing a home or education or business development or something on those lines. But again, the legislature, what was done in this past session was increasing the amount of that contribution credit. So prior to the most recent session, House Bill 2164, the contribution credit or the credit amount was 70% of your contribution. So if you made a $100 contribution, you'd get a credit worth $70. That has now been adjusted, and we'll go into effect shortly here, where that contribution amount will become 90%, or the credit will become 90% of the contribution. And again, I'll touch on it on the last slide, I suppose, of how some of the recent changes with the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, how that will interplay with some of our contribution credits as well. But this one is up for review, and that was even discussed in this past legislative session as well, so that will be upcoming, and hopefully we'll have more information as we move forward on how that filters through, those federal changes filter through to the Oregon credit. But that credit, again, is rounding out kind of the larger group or larger cost to extend group of credits for this 2021 session. With the list of the remaining ones here, and I wasn't planning to go into detail on these ones here, but this is the remainders on the list that will be reviewed in 2021. So in terms of the federal changes and some of the implications, one thing this committee has definitely heard a lot about over the last few sessions has been, primarily in the case for the tax credits that we're talking about or we'll be talking about in 2021, is the changes made to the state and local tax deduction. So the limit, there's a $10,000 limit, the SALT limit put in place at the federal level that limits a taxpayer's itemized deductions for state and local taxes. And that really came out. What followed then was in some cases, states were looking at, well, what are ways that we could work around this cap at the federal level to hold our taxpayers harmless? And you had some states looking at ways where taxpayers could donate the money into some state fund, and then those funds would be shifted in a way to maybe their general fund or to support the spending priorities of that state, pretty much in line with what they were doing before, but it'd work around this SALT cap limit on state and local taxes that could be deducted, because if you make the donation or the contribution, you could transform that that state and local tax deduction more or less into a charitable deduction, which would still be allowed. But so following up on that, the IRS put out proposed regulations that have now become final regulations, more or less saying if you do get a tax credit at the state level for contributions made, so if you get a 90% credit for, you can contribute $100 and you get a credit worth $90, you can deduct $10 as a charitable contribution, but the other 90 is not allowed because you're receiving a credit for it. So that was one of the big changes by the IRS, the proposed regulations that have since become final. They did include a safe harbor for itemizers that are below the 10,000 SALT cap, but other than that, the proposed regulations did pretty much go in force as the original proposed ones became the final. There wasn't really any change there. So that discussion topic that the committee's been hearing about for a session or two did go into effect over the summer. So that's one of the things with the IDA contribution credit that we'll be keeping an eye on. There's also contributions to the child care is up for review, and venture development as well. These are all contribution credits that will be up in 2021. We'll be trying to look at that and see how the most recent tax year's data comes in post these IRS changes to see if that has revenue implications on the cost to extend. And just as one other thing that we're looking at that's somewhat related to these tax credits certainly is the auction tax credits that we have for film and video and opportunity grant fund. And so we'll be seeing, I believe Film and Video has an auction set for the end of this month into early October. So we'll start to get information that will help us to know how successful these auction and contribution tax credits are after the legislature made changes of both in terms of for the IDA, moving that contribution amount or that credit amount per contribution to 90% from 70. And then on the auction tax credit side, the legislature lowered that reserve price for those auctions this past 19 session. So that's something, again, we'll be keeping an eye on. We'll hopefully be getting more information on. I don't know if we'll have a full understanding by the next short session. Again, a lot of these donations are made near the end of the tax year, so we probably won't be seeing those for a little while. But hopefully we will have something, certainly a much better understanding prior to the 2021 longer session as well. So again, we're starting from LRO's perspective, we're starting the process of preparing the next report. So any type of information that you think would be helpful or anything you'd like for us to include in the policy analysis that's not already required by statute, please reach out to us so that we can try to get that included in the next report for you all.
Thank you, Kyle. I do appreciate you getting ahead of this by more than a year. I don't know if it's a flaw, but one of the things is not covered in that 2013 legislation that put in these automatic sunsets is a system by which these credits are reviewed. Sometimes these credits are renewed, they go to a policy committee, just one credit, and then they get referred to another policy committee, then they get referred to the tax expenditure committee. Sometimes they go straight to the committee, sometimes they do neither, they just get added on and it's one big bill, and it's not a particularly beautiful process, and we still need to work on that. So at least getting out in front of that, I think, helps. Senator Riley?
Yeah, on the comment you just made, if I may.
Yes.
One of the reasons, of course, that things go to a policy committee before coming to the tax credit committee is certainly policy committees can decide that we shouldn't even review them, they just go away. And that's a policy committee prerogative when they go to a policy committee.
Yeah. Okay, we'll make a hard segue into sports betting. We have the Oregon Lottery here. It is football season.
Good afternoon, Chair House, Senators. I'm Matt Shelby from the Oregon Lottery. Director Pack would have liked to be here. Unfortunately, he's out of town on business, and so today you get me. I'm going to do my best to give you an update on where we are relative to sports betting. Back up just a little bit, talk about some of the legal aspects of sports betting, kind of where we've been here in Oregon, where we're going at a national level, what other states are doing, why we think at the lottery, sports betting is a good add to the gaming portfolio. And then talk a little bit about what specifically the sports betting game will look like. And I think the question that everybody's asking us these days is, so when? Soon, and I'll go into that in a little bit more detail. This is what I have. If you have questions that I'm not gonna cover, feel free to chime in, and I will do my best to either answer your questions or commit to getting you one. So sports betting's been legal in Oregon. If you recall, we had a game called Sports Action. It was a parlay game where people could wager on the outcome of a number of NFL games. Because Oregon had it before the feds enacted the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act, Oregon was grandfathered in, and we continued to offer that game until the mid-2000s when the commission discontinued that game. In May of 2018, the Supreme Court overturned PASMA and really sent it back to the states to regulate sports betting on their own. And so since then, 13 states, including Oregon, have legal sports betting. If you follow the news, you know that Chinook Winds opened a couple of weeks ago. And so they actually have a sports book on site that is taking wagers as we speak. Many other states, so the states in blue have passed recent legislation that legalized sports betting. The dark grays are in process. So as you can see, we are one of many states moving this direction. And early results show that revenue is exceeding expectations in New Jersey and really back east, where we've seen kind of the most active wagering. So why do we think it's a good idea? You know, lottery, we like to say we want lots of people playing a little. And what that means is that we want to offer a wide variety of games that appeal to lots of different people. We think the addition of sports betting allows us to increase the revenue pie in a responsible way without asking people that are currently playing our games to play or wager more. Sports betting appeals to a different demographic. Many of them are already playing right now, both in Las Vegas, but also online. We know that Oregonians are wagering on sports, either at legal places out of the state, but also illegally online. And some of our testing and surveying tells us that if Oregonians have a choice, they would move that wagering to a legal regulated sports betting platform. And so that's really our biggest goal, is to really attract those people that are already wagering on sports.
Senator,
questions?
Yes, Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. Can you explain a little bit more, please, what you mean, how you know that about Oregonians, if given the option? Where does that information come from?
So we do a formal survey every 2 years of gaming behavior. We also, our research and analytics folks also rely on a number of national studies and surveys that break the responses down by region and by state. So. And Senator Taylor, I can get you some of those if you want to see some of the homework behind these.
And then follow up
these numbers,
please.
Senator Taylor.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Hess. So, but that's not the same as saying that most Oregonians want this. You're talking about the people who are already participating.
Exactly. Yeah. So,
I want to be clear. I mean, we don't really know that whether or not most Oregonians are in support of this.
We have not done formal polling on that, but if our public email address and my phone number are any indication of just anecdotally, there is a heavy appetite for it, we're getting asked on the daily.
Okay, thank you.
Revenue projections: how much are we actually going to bring in? Do we think? And at this point, I would say these are all projections. We haven't had sports betting in the state in more than a decade, and when we did, it was a different product. Again, we arrived at these numbers by taking player behavior, both kind of conceptually, but also real behavior that we're seeing in other states, taking that behavior, applying it to Oregon's population, and that's how we get these numbers. On the far left, that column, you'll see the handle. That's typically the number you read in the headlines, you know, the $300 million. And that's the total amount wagered. If you are running a fairly balanced book, the vast majority of that goes back to players in the form of winnings. You're taking wagers from people that wager on one side of a sporting event, and you're giving it to people that wagered on the other side. And along the way, you're taking a little cut of that. If you follow the columns all the way over to the far column, current period net profit, that is the amount of money that we believe sports betting will bring to the lottery. That includes, baked into that number would be transfers, direct transfers, but also potential administrative savings at the end of the year. Also included in that number would be some contingency money that we would have to hold back just for prize volatility. But long and the short of it is, we're talking tens of millions over a three-year period, not hundreds. But we do believe that this is a way to kind of incrementally grow that revenue pie. So what will our game look like? Well, first, it has a name and a logo. It's called Oregon Lottery Scoreboard, and it is coming soon, I promise you. We are rolling first with a mobile version of that. We had a Oregon Lottery app that we launched last summer that was primarily a convenience app where folks could check their numbers, find lottery retailers, that type of thing. This will be a different app. It will require players to create a Oregon Lottery account. It will offer a full range of domestic international sports. I mentioned parlay. That was the old sports action. This will, in addition, this will offer single game betting. So who's going to win one way or another, but also in-game betting, such as who will have most yards in the second half, that type of thing.
I'm sorry, Senator Hess. I have a question here about this slide, but then I wanted to go back to the previous slide to understand why. Maybe we should just go back a few slides. So when you were talking about the current period net profit, and you're talking about the product expenses versus the other expenses, and I'm reading here the footnotes here, and I think I understand what those footnotes are. So we're going to be paying a third party is going to be profiting from this as well.
Yes.
Okay. And so they're going to make how much? What's the percentage? I mean, we're going to contract the lottery? Oregon Lottery is going to contract with this third party.
Yes. So the bottom row actually shows that GGR is gross gaming revenue, and that is total wagered minus the winnings. And as you can see, the percentages are those are based on the gross gaming revenue. So sports betting is a fairly small margin business. We are going with an off the shelf sports betting product and provider. And yes, it will cost a significant amount of money.
Okay, and so the other expenses, $16.5 million. Okay, and then the costs are only going to go up. And I'm confused as to why it's going to cost as much as that. I'm just confused about that. And so why would the cost keep going up and up at that rate?
So we are launching both the sports betting game, and there is a company that we're using for that. But we're also launching a new a new purchasing channel, right? We're going mobile. And so we have to ensure that when Oregon players load money into a player account, that the financial flows operate as they should be. So we have we are incurring banking expenses, payment provider expenses. This app will be geofenced to Oregon and off of tribal land. So there are ongoing expenses baked into that as well. And we have a robust player verification that we have to do on the front end. To verify that the players that are creating the accounts are indeed over 21 and who they say they are. And that also requires a fair amount of third-party cost to get there.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up?
Yes. Senator Taylor.
The other, and then you were going forward, we can talk at another time. I still have a lot of questions about that. And the side slides going forward, when you were talking about the international games, can you tell me a little bit more how is it decided of what people will be allowed to bet on and not bet on? And
so our product team will decide exactly what sports to offer. Because we're going with an off-the-shelf provider, they have a very robust catalog. So international sports, so if you think all of the European soccer leagues or Aussie rules football, those types of things. So we anticipate the majority of the wagering is going to be done on American sports, but those are also available. It's going to really be up to our product team to determine kind of how visible those are and how marketed they really are.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Riley.
So to follow up on that, so I'm assuming that there'll be times when you try out a new sport and it doesn't work out and you drop it. Does that sound right?
Yeah, it could. So, Senator Riley, for example, if we have, badminton or something, I guess they're fairly obscure, that people just really aren't wagering anything on, people aren't playing that game, especially on a mobile app that you have limited real estate. And so I think you may at some point be able to get to that if you really dug for it. But yes, we would not actively, when you logged in, you wouldn't see that as an option. I anticipate that the majority of the real estate, the majority of the sports that players are going to see are going to be the larger U.S. leagues. So I mentioned that 21 plus, that will be geofenced in Oregon and off of tribal land. In the next couple of slides, I'm going to talk about some of the responsible gaming tools that are baked into this. Just note that, like all of our other games, prizes will be subject to the same tax withholdings and DHS, OHA, child support, checks and offsets. And that will occur in a little bit different way because people actually have player accounts. We know who you are as opposed to the anonymous play that we offer today. So different, little bit different process, but the end result will be the same. I mentioned the three main types of wagering that will be available. So single game, parlay, and in-game wagering. In-game actually is one that we really think that it will present some good opportunities to our current lottery retailers. Not everybody that watches sports wagers on sports, but I would venture to say that most people that wager on sports watch it. And this is a really, I think, good opportunity for our retailers to advertise some of the game availability that they have. I mentioned responsible gaming is kind of built into this platform. At the beginning, when people are establishing their player account, we require them to set a deposit limit for themselves. We will also give them information about kind of what the average is and maybe some ideas there. We recognize that everybody's situation is different, but that everybody on the front end should be setting a limit for their use. The play history is no longer anonymous. As I mentioned, we know who you are, but also players will have immediate access to see how much they've wagered, how much they've spent. I don't know if any of you have the Starbucks app on your phone, but I do, my wife does. It allows me to see how much we spend at Starbucks in a month. And that actually has been the source of several conversations about how much we spend at Starbucks. Similar kind of concept, really. Right now with video lottery or scratch-its or any of our other products, it's a cash basis. With this, you're using your player account to place the wagers. And so it's very easy. It does it for you. Very easy to see how much you've wagered in a month or a week or 6 months or a year. And we believe and research shows us that the players that have more information make better choices. The odds and the payouts and how the game works, all that's very clear. On the app itself, before you place a wager, you're going to know exactly, if I put $10 down on this particular bet, how much do I stand to win? If any of you follow sports betting, you know lines will change depending on injury reports or a number of different things. And so while that may fluctuate, we want to make sure that our players have really clear access to that information before they place a wager. In addition to a deposit limit, players have the ability to set a loss limit. So they can set whatever limit they want, and when they hit that, they would they would be notified that they have hit their limit. If that is not enough, if the information is not enough, players have a couple of other kind of more substantial intervention options. They may opt for up to a 30-day timeout, where essentially it just freezes their account. They can't wager. They can't deposit money. They can withdraw any money that's there, but they can't really do anything else. If that doesn't work, we offer self-exclusion for a number of different time periods up to permanent self-exclusion. So if a player gets themselves or discovers that they just cannot handle this in a responsible way, they have the ability to exclude themselves permanently. Because of the robust verification on the front end, a player would not be able to self-exclude a month later, determine that they want to wager again, and then set up another account either under a different name or, you know, under a different whatever kind of circumstance. Really, it comes down to one player per person. And so the self-exclusion really is a permanent self-exclusion. And then I just want to note here, because we've been talking about this for a year now, and we also have been talking about the fact that while we are offering sports betting on a mobile channel, the lottery commission, the director, and the governor's office have all expressed they've expressed no desire to offer high-velocity VLT-type games on a mobile device. So what you won't see coming out of lottery anytime in at least as long as the current leadership is there, is a VLT game on a mobile device. We don't think that falls under the kind of our dual mission of commensurate with the public good.
Senator Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two or three questions, if I may. First, on the deposit limit, is that, how exactly does that work? If I set a deposit limit of $100 and at some point in the future I go, oh, $100 is not enough, can I change that deposit limit after setting up the account at any time?
You can change, Senator, Chair Hass, Senator Riley, you can change that deposit limit. You can reduce the deposit limit at any time. If you'd like to increase it, you can increase it once every, I want to say there's a 24-hour waiting period. And then I think if you go to increase it another time, I believe it's a week. So there are some built-in kind of weight limits in there for folks that want to increase that deposit limit.
So if I want to increase, the first time I want to increase it, I go, I want to increase this, and you won't let me do it for 24 hours.
That's right.
And then the next time, a week later, what's the third time?
Senator Riley, I don't know, but I'm sure we can get that back to you.
Okay. And the loss limit, same kind of question. How do I change that?
Chair Hass, Senator Riley, the loss limit is not a required thing. It is an optional choice that players may have. And the loss limit, they could increase the loss limit. I believe it falls in line with the deposit. But again, I can commit to getting you some more specific info on that.
Okay, and then finally, just a comment. There's a impression, and I know that it's there because I get questions all the time, that I'm opposed to sports betting. I'm not. What I'm concerned about is PDAs. Once we get any kind of betting on personal devices, that concerns me because I know, and you know, that no matter what kind of verification you do, there's always that possibility of someone using someone else's betting limit. And since it's a PDA, which anybody in the household could pick up, I'm concerned about that, the betting going to PDAs. I'm very concerned about that. And I know that you right now are not going to do high velocity games, but that's the most concerning, of course. And that was the reason in the beginning that I was extremely opposed to going to PDAs at all, is because of high velocity games and the potential of going there. And I think that the legislature, and I certainly will, needs to be alert and watching to make sure that this doesn't go where we don't think it should go. And I believe that you think it shouldn't go there as well, but I think we have to be very vigilant.
Thank you.
Senator, I would say we share your concerns, especially on the underage use of this product. You know, we know that two things are gonna have to happen for someone to access this app on a mobile phone. They're going to have to unlock the phone, but if you If your kids or any, or someone's kids or any, like my kids, they know how to unlock my phone. Mm-hmm. Once you're in the phone, there will be another credential that is specific to the SportsBet app that a player will have to log in. So on my phone right now, I have a banking app that has access to all of my accounts, and if someone got into that, they could do a whole lot of damage to me. Just like that banking app, the lottery scoreboard app will automatically log you out when you close it out. So, you know, I think we've taken a number of steps to mitigate that risk through technology as best we can. I think we all recognize, though, that that we are not going to be able to regulate away bad or absentee parenting. On the VLT, the high velocity games, we absolutely share your concern there as well, and would look to the legislature to help us or partner with us. We can put our commission has broad rulemaking authority to govern its games, but it's just a, you know, at the end of the day, it's an administrative rule. We would actively seek partnership with the legislature to take administrative rules that prevent those types of games and further substantiate them in state law.
This reminds me of the phone call I had to make to Apple Computer iTunes one day to tell them that my son didn't mean to buy $600 in Angry Bird credits. Right. And,
absolutely.
And if I may follow up on that, I heard you say that you can't ever regulate bad parenting or absentee parenting. And the fact is that when the betting, when the games are on our own devices, that is the lottery's devices, we can. A child won't be able to go into a establishment and do betting on the lottery machines. But as you point out, we cannot remotely determine who's actually holding that PDA.
That's correct.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hass. So does one have to be an Oregon resident? Will they have to be an Oregon resident to do this?
Chair Hass, Senator Taylor, anyone can establish a player account from anywhere. Anywhere in the world, you could establish an account. To actually place a wager, you have to be inside the state of Oregon.
A resident? Or?
No, you have to just be in the state of Oregon. So just same with any of our other games. You know, we offer games to anybody who's here, and we would offer sports betting to anybody who is here in the state.
Okay, so follow up. So you have to have a GPS would then say that that device is sitting, and somehow technologically no one can trick that?
Chair Senator Taylor, that is, the answer is yes. That's one of the expenses that we're incurring is geolocation services on that app. If you're using a computer, you're logging in, you have an IP address, that's a different technology that allows us to know where that computer is. But yes, on the mobile device, we'll use a geolocation technology similar to a Google Maps or a Waze.
Okay, and then just one last question, Senator Hass. Thank you for your patience. So the revenue, if I remember correctly, it looks like it's at the beginning, you think it'll bring about $40 million in for the state?
Yeah, over a three-year period.
Over a three-year period, bring in $40 million. So three biennium or 3 year? Why is it three?
Chair Hass, Senator Taylor, we operate on an annual, so more of a kind of traditional annual business year. So most of our numbers are annual. So these are not biennial numbers.
Okay.
These are annual numbers.
Okay. So I just a comment, Senator Hass. I understand that the way that the law was structured, that was already allowed, and then it was made illegal at the federal level, and now it's been overturned. I personally don't know that I really believe that Oregonians have had a chance to weigh in on whether or not they want this. It's just that this was a holdover from a law that was already in place, as I understand it. And so I just really hope that this is kind of worth it for $40 million over 3 years to potentially be people who perhaps are already struggling with an addiction around gambling. I don't know the details around the population that will be participating in this, but I just want to go ahead and put on the record that I do have concerns about the state entering into expanding what the lottery does. And obviously we need money, and this is why this is being considered. I just hope that we are very, very careful, because I hate to see the addiction expand the way that we've already seen it with traditional lottery games that has happened. You did a great job answering the questions, and I appreciate your being straightforward and frank. The candor was greatly appreciated, so thank you for doing that. So
that's a good segue into, I got a couple more slides, but responsible gaming, we agree, and we believe that sports betting actually brings in a different type of player, and potentially with different types of challenges. And so there's a couple of things we're doing to help respond to that. We are training our hotline staff around responsible gaming with some online resources, some scripts, helping to train our staff to know when to direct somebody to the helpline that is operated by our partners at OHA. Up until this point, our hotline staff have dealt primarily with retailers and more of a business-to-business kind of support. But we know launching a product where the lottery is the one selling to the consumer, we're going to get those types of kind of consumer-facing questions, and we're ramping up to be prepared for that. Senator Riley, to your kind of example of wanting to continue upping your limit, you know, imagine a player who calls the hotline frustrated that they can't continually raise their limit. You know, they might think that it's just a customer service issue, but it really might be that they need to talk to somebody, or they could be helped talking to somebody from the helpline. So working with our staff to know kind of how to make some of those soft transitions is work that we're doing right now. And we also know that if we are sending people to the helpline and they are a different type of gambler, they might, again, need to be supported in different ways. And so, again, that's we are endeavoring to partnership with OHA, and we'll continue. We've done prevalence studies dating back to about 1999, the prevalence of problem gambling in the state. It's right around 3%, and frankly, you know, there's about 3% of the population that just shouldn't play our games, and we will continue to do those prevalent studies. So as this rolls out in the future, we should have more, and would be able to answer questions about have we seen a corresponding rise in prevalence. So that's something we'll be monitoring. The timeline for the launch—that's the question that we get on a daily basis. We are right now in testing. We have an app. Well, we have two apps, and we have a computer-based platform. We are testing all of the things like geolocation. So if you're in Vancouver, does it work? It shouldn't. But if you're on Hayden Island, does it work? If you're on a tribal reservation, what about someone trying to spoof the account creation or various things like that? So that's all the work that is being done right now. We had originally put a stake in the ground in the spring, in kind of internally, that we wanted to have this ready in time for the beginning of the NFL season. That was an internal goal aligned or intended to kind of drive alignment and a sense of urgency inside our shop. But we know that as we get closer to launch, you know, the testing, the remediation, that is really going to drive our launch date and not an arbitrary date that we picked, you know, 4 months ago. We've seen how that turns out. So we anticipate going live in just a matter of weeks, and we'll be actively monitoring both the activity and the revenue from there. Future plans, we've been talking all about mobile right now, because that was frankly the fastest way to get to market. As soon as that launches, we will be quickly turning our attention to kiosks. Imagine an ATM-sized machine that you would put in a sports bar or tavern that would give a person the ability to place a wager without establishing a player account. Some people don't want to have the financial stuff on their phone. But they might want to walk in, if they're at a tavern, they might want to walk in and put a $10 bill in and place a wager. That is, we're looking at that early 2020, and at least in a pilot form. And from the look on your face, you might have a question about that?
No, I just haven't said, thank you. So just the whole idea of placing limits and having player ID, which has always been a huge controversial issue up until now, then we just create a completely other avenue for someone to just bypass all of that.
It is another channel, and it very much is like the rest of our product. So yes, it would be a more of a cash-based operation, but it would be in a more of a, kind of to Senator Riley's point, more of a controlled environment. It closes, and you've got to go home, and it would be in an age-restricted environment, so very similar to the video lottery terminals that we have now. Finally, a product very similar to the old Sports Action that would be available to all through our entire retailer network. We don't exactly know what that looks like in terms of how it would play, but I can tell you it's not going to be a Scantron form that you're filling out after looking through the back pages of the Oregonian Sports Section, which is how we used to do it. But that we're looking more kind of later 2020 to have that, and it would be available to all Oregon Lottery retailers that currently sell Powerball and such. And with that, that's my presentation. Happy to answer any other questions you may have.
Thank you, Matt. Well done. When you said these accounts would be set and you would keep track of the winnings and the revenue, it almost sounded like you would keep that record that could be made available, almost like a 1099 to the Department of Revenue or something. Is that how you envision that? Is that how this is going to be set up?
Chair Haas, we have right now for any win over $600, we have to generate a W-2G, I believe, is the official form for tax purposes. And so we would continue to generate those on any winnings over $600. But you are touching on something that we are working on in rule, and this actually points to another place where I think we would seek to partner with the legislature to actually further solidify the player protection, and that's that information. We're collecting a lot of data around not just win history, but play history if you're using that Oregon Lottery account. We believe that personally identifiable player information, the release of that would not serve the public. We think the aggregate data could, but we are establishing rules that would kind of prevent us from releasing that. But again, would absolutely seek to partner with the legislature to kind of further those privacy protections.
Yes, sir. No.
Thank you, Chair Haas. I got a couple questions, and one of them actually was that, but I want to follow up on it. So it sounds like you just told us that, let's just pick a random name. If I wanted to find a betting history on, I don't know, Chuck Riley, random name, could I just write you guys and do a FOIA, and is that information public?
We don't, Chair Haas, Senator Knope, we don't believe it is. We think it actually falls, there are existing public records exemptions that would prevent us from releasing that. We think there are a number, actually, that would fall within that. I would liken it to educational or student information, and bear with me for a second. There is no public interest in knowing how my child did on their Dibbles testing last year. There is absolute public interest in knowing how the students at my child's school did on that test. So that's kind of the difference that we're looking at. So we do believe that there is an absolute public interest in how what Oregonians are spending on this game, even what games are the most popular, that type of information. But when you break it down to a level of detail that is identifiable to a person, we think that that does not meet the public records threshold, the test.
I don't expect you to know this today, but could you get back to me with the Oregon revised statute that you guys would rely on as it pertains to the privacy of this information as it relates to individual type information?
Chair Haas, Senator Knop, yes, I can.
If we have that to the chair and distributed to the whole committee, I would like that.
Sure. And at the beginning, you mentioned, and I wasn't 100% clear, it sounded like this scoreboard was just for professional sports. So there isn't any college football or any college betting?
Chair Haas, Senator Knop, at this time, no. We are sticking to professional sports. Chinook Winds has taken a different stance, and they are offering collegiate wagering. It's something that we... I won't say we will never entertain, but the whole reason that sports betting went away the first time was concerns with the NCAA, with our university system losing or potentially losing out on championship events, that type of thing. If we were to get to a place where we offered collegiate wagering, it would have to be in partnership and communication, consultation with our higher education folks, with the governor's office, potentially with the legislature, and frankly, we haven't had time to do that. So we are sticking with professional sports at launch, but I anticipate that broader conversation is going to come up at some point.
Thank you.
Thank you, Matt. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, we have one item left. I'll move to that before we'll just finish off with that. Day is here on kind of a quick overview of the payroll tax that we passed with respect to the Paid Family Leave Act in this 2019 session. And not to go on a diatribe here, but that tax did not go through the House Revenue Committee or the Senate Revenue Committee, and I think it should have. Not that it would, not because we wanted to decide it, but because of the context that we need when we pass other things. And for that matter, the same goes for the provider tax as well. So anyway, appreciate you putting this together and walking us through.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee, Dave Beck, Legislative Revenue Office. So we're gonna have a very brief look at Oregon's paid family and medical leave insurance, and the focus on payroll tax and funding the program. So the contents of the presentation, what is paid family leave in the US, and what are the states offering PFL, paid family leave, and also focusing on funding methods. We'll look at Oregon's program. And first look at the revenue impact. Gotta understand that this is a very preliminary estimate. And further details on contribution by employers and employees and how the rate is set, and timeline for payroll tax deduction and benefit payments, and appendix provides details on payroll tax. So paid family leave is it's about partially or fully compensated time away from work for specific and generally significant family caregiving needs. So for example, new child, serious illness of a close family member. By the way, at the federal level, we have the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993. So if it is about workers' own medical issues, it's termed medical or disability of the worker, and the other family members' caregiving needs is about family leave. The federal law requires private sector employers to provide paid family leave of any kind, but there are employers who are offering PFL. Eight states and DC either offered state PFL, or in the process of creating one. Earlier in the year, Connecticut passed a bill, and Oregon followed it. The next four slides are about how other states are doing in terms of PFL. California started. The funding is through 1% state disability insurance tax, and it covers family leave and also a worker's own medical leave. When the rate is close to one or high, you could interpret that rate as covering medical and family altogether. When the rate is much lower, in the order of 0.2 or 0.1, you could safely assume that that's only about family leave. The DC taxes employers to provide medical and family. Massachusetts is a little complicated, but if you click on the link below, contribution rates or tax rates for employers, excuse me.
You know, Dave, I don't think you need to go through every state.
Right. So let's get back to where we were at. And New Jersey covers family leave using 0.08 tax rate on employees. New York State, 0.27% tax on employees. Rhode Island, 1.1% on employees. That covers medical. Washington State is one of the most recent ones, 0.4% tax on employers and employees sharing. So Oregon's Hospital 2005 created Oregon's paid family and medical leave insurance program, and it covers family leave, family members' caring needs, medical leave, workers' own medical issues, and then safe leave, it's about domestic violence and sexual violence, or some other types, harassment included. Allows Oregon Employment Department either to administer the program or contract with the third party, directs OED to set the contribution rate. The maximum rate is 1%. Specifies that the contribution be split between employees and employers, the 60-40%. Smaller employers are exempt from contribution. Revenue impact in the order of $1 billion a year. The split is not exactly 40-60 because there are exempt employers. More on contribution. 40-60 split. The rate is applied to employee gross wages or taxable wages. Employers may pay or elect to pay employees portion as employer offered benefit. Employers with PFML, paid family and medical leave equivalent plans, they have to clear with the OED first, but if they do have such plan, they don't have to contribute to this insurance fund. Employers with fewer than 25 employers are exempt from paying their portion of the contribution, but if such employers opt into the program or pay into the program, they're eligible for grants to help cover the cost of replacement workers. Employees of exempt employers are still required to contribute their share, worker share, 60%. Self-employed and tribal government employers can opt into the program. The maximum contribution rate, again, it's up to 1%. Rates will vary depending on program cost The impact analysis assumes 1%, the maximum rate, but if we are talking about less than 1%, you could use proportional decline or proportional ratios, rates, whatever, to come up with the revenue impact. So there are certain funding needs. For example, the measure requires the fund balance to be enough to pay at least 6 months of benefit. That's one of the requirements. On top of the contributions to the fund as inflow, the outflow of funds in the form of benefit payments and program costs will also come into play in deciding the adequacy of the fund balance. Timeline for contributions, that's payroll tax deductions and benefit payments. Contribution doesn't start until January 1, 2020. Benefit payments doesn't start until January 2023. We made some assumptions to come up with a revenue impact. It's, we can provide the details if you like. Benefits are capped as specified in the measure, but there are floors too, so minimum payments too. As in the case in the unemployment insurance trust fund management, the contribution rate can fluctuate depending on funding needs and be conceivably set below the maximum rate of 1%. The appendix provides details on payroll tax.
Thank you, Senator Taylor. I know your handiwork was there.
And by the way, Senator Taylor was one of the chief sponsors mm-hmm. of the bill.
No, that is nice to have an overview. There's some details there, but we won't have to go into all that right at this exact moment. The intention was never for it to be full 1%. How the rate in the setting is what will, there's a number of weeks that are specified in the bill. And so what needs to happen is the calculation needs to occur to figure out what it will cost to provide those number of weeks of leave. And then once that calculation is made, then we can talk about what the rate will actually be, if that makes any sense. But the intention was never for it to be, at this point, for it to be a full 1% of the salary. It'll most likely be less than that. So. But yeah, no, that was a nice overview.
Senator Canoe. All right, thanks, Dave. All right, committee covered a lot of ground today. Thank you. Our September interim finance and revenue committee is in the books. And if there are no other business items before us, we'll close down. I am adjourned.